Life is hard. Yes, ministry is hard. Marriage is hard. Parenting's hard. Like, there is no avoiding the hard. It's hard to be a person in a broken world.
Hello, and welcome to Working with me, Dan Doriani, hosting a podcast where we explore faith, work, culture, and the way believers can make a difference in their corner of the world. So my guest today is Brent Harriman. Brent is a campus pastor for 8 years. Then he became an overseer of campus pastors for an organization called Reformed University Ministry with the fellowships on each campus. And then after he did that, total of 13 years campus ministry. So we're going to talk about college students, young adults, a fair amount. Then he became a pastor 6 years ago in Knoxville, Tennessee, home of the Vols, woo-woo. And that church has thrived and become a pretty big church, a very vibrant and healthy church under his leadership. Brent, it is a delight to have you with us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So today we're having a partnership. This is not exactly an interview the way I often have these podcasts. We're gonna have a conversation more than drawing you out. And one of the things we want to talk about a lot is what I'm going to call the near crisis, almost a crisis in pastoral leadership, especially the very few people who seem to have a desire to become pastoral leaders, by which, you know, and you can comment in a second. A lot of people want to go into ministry. They want to go to campus ministry, youth ministry, be counselors, church administrators, but not a whole lot of people want to take up the call to lead right now. You've been seeing that too, I think, right?
Definitely that. I think the only thing that I would add to that, I'm not sure that there is a rush to do any level of vocational ministry right now, but I would say the bottom of the barrel does seem to be the tip of the spear type leadership.
Yeah, right. So we had a conversation about this a while ago. I wrote something up as a consequence of it, that there are probably five big things we could talk about. I'm going to name them, and then I'm going to let you decide which one we want to talk about, all right? So the reasons why people are leadership averse, why they do things like create logos that maybe never will be used, but create logos in which, you know, there's a hammock between two trees, and that's the logo for our, that could be the logo for our ministry, because we want to make sure everybody knows how to relax and nobody works too hard, which is, you know, very much in the air. The first reason then, you and I said, is perhaps a fear of work-life imbalance. That's one. Another one is the politicization of the church, so that, you know, most evangelical pastors are conservative politically, but that doesn't mean they're Republican necessarily. And churches have become more and more partisan. Number three is the general decline of Western Christianity, meaning it's just not as popular. Churches aren't growing the way they did. It's not as cool. It's anti-cool to be a pastor. And then, of course, the fact that we live in the age of anxiety, and therefore people are averse to anything that would put them in a leadership position where they might be recipients of anger charges, or, you know, you failed or something like that. And the last one is the common charge, sometimes often valid, that pastors are corrupt. It's not always true, but there's a sense that failed pastors have tarred the whole occupation. So those are five. What do you want to talk about first, Brent?
Maybe the first one that you mentioned, maybe just because it's mentioned first, or it's one that definitely resonates with me, the work-life imbalance. It does seem that there is a real fear of that. And I would just say that part of that is a legitimate fear. I do think it's a cultural reaction to, let's say, the last two generations of people in vocational ministry, to at least the generation prior to them, or the two prior to the last two, or to the present two generations, there really was a significant imbalance between work and life, and particularly when that gets spiritualized, that can develop what I would say a legitimate aversion to people wanting to move into the ministry for that reason. However, I think that maybe abuse does not negate proper use here. Right. And I think that there might be too much emphasis put on the reaction to not wanting that unhealthy imbalance. And it's created maybe a swing of the pendulum in the other direction.
Yeah, yeah. So you have a wonderful wife and wonderful children, and you have hobbies and other interests. So you want to have time for your wife and your kids and your friends and your whatever your, I don't know what your hobbies are right now, but you've always had a lot of side interests, we might say. And you want to keep time for those. And that's proper, right?
Yeah, I would say healthy. I mean, in talking to campus ministers and developing material of what I would call, I mean, you could call it different things, but let's just say proper soul or self-care. As when it came to kind of points of application, I guess I was in a mood to alliterate. Okay. And so I would talk about then, and I still think this is fine. Rest, recreation, and relationships are three key ingredients to, let's just say, proper or healthy self-care or soul care. And so, yeah, I think that resonates with what you're saying about my own interest. I do think, you and I both, one of the things that, while we don't share the exact same recreational endeavors apart from hiking and I think just general love for the outdoors, for example, the state of Colorado,
right?
You know, where you play tennis, I ride a bike, and, you know, there's some other nuances there. It is a little interesting to me how few people, period, but even pastors, actually have legitimate hobbies that they're passionate about. And that, I mean, that could be a whole other thing. It's related, but it is an interesting thing to note.
I remember I was interviewed by a pastor, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, and he kept coming back to my hobbies. And I was thinking, what is the cause of this? I found out later the cause of it is that he just didn't have any hobbies, that he spent all of his time working. A number of years ago, I did a little survey. I was in a pastor's group of large church pastors for about 10 or 11 years. I was a large church pastor and was in a group with large church pastors. It still exists, but it's a little bit different now. And several of the people in the group actually worked hard to stay fit. Actually, most of the people in the group ran or cycled or played handball or something in a fairly serious way. And yet, there was a heart attack, and one became drug addicted, and another had a financial crisis. One almost died because they'd been working so hard they'd exhausted their immune system. And so I asked them, how many hours are you working? And exactly one member of the group, 15 people, said he worked on average less than 70 hours a week. One. And he worked 55, which took the place of the couple guys that worked 75 to 80.
Yeah. Do you bring that up just in the context of if you have an aversion to going into pastoral ministry for a potential work-life imbalance, you're going to have a job doing something? And are you making the point that it's likely that a job outside of vocational ministry would also tax that same margin or boundary?
Well, I mean, it was a room full of leaders. And, you know, if they weren't church leaders, I think most of them would have been business leaders. I think it's fair to say that most of them would have been leaders of some kind. And they've all had a high work ethic and believed in what they were doing. So I think a lot of them would have been overworkers anyway. But I'm also copping to your gentle charge that baby boomers and maybe, you know, a generation or half generation younger are prone to overwork. And the next generation needs to correct what they have seen in my generation is the way I would say it. It's a genuine problem in people that are 50 plus, I would say.
Well, I appreciate the concession and being, you know, one generation removed from you. I would say that we've overreacted to that. And that's what, as you and I, you know, what we're talking about, it's led to, this aversion to ambition, and something that I've appreciated in some of our conversations about this subject, is you distinguishing, let's just say, between worldly ambition and godly ambition. And I think that that's not a distinction that most people would argue or uphold. And we've ended up essentially concluding, I think by default, that all ambition, at least from a biblical standpoint or Christian worldview, would be not healthy. And there's a lot of scriptural examples that would be contrary to that. One of my favorite being where Paul, the Apostle Paul, communicates that it is his desire to be all things to all people in order to save as many as possible.
That's his ambition, right?
That sounds pretty ambitious to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know how work-life imbalance was present in Paul's life. We do know that
he seems to work pretty hard,
and he was pretty nimble. He seemed to, be strategic in his lack of being tethered in marriage and right. how that was helpful in his kingdom advancing it. But nevertheless, yeah, I mean, I think you and I are both recognizing that it's a legitimate concern to want to have a healthy, whatever we want to call it, balance is probably the easy word there.
Yeah, I hate the word balance because, you know, it sounds so Aristotelian, like we got to find the extremes and avoid the extremes and just sit in the middle. But let's agree that ambition certainly can be selfish and self-promoting and vain and proud and destructive. There's no doubt about that. And most of the time, ambition comes up in the Bible. It is actually bad, but not every time, not even close to every time. And, you know, Paul says, actually uses the word ambition. It's my ambition to plant churches where Christ has never been named before. He wants to, that's his goal. You know, it's also true, even as I was listening to you and Paul working so hard, he also spent time on boats. And there's probably a lot of downtime on a boat. And he also spent quite a bit of time in jail. And I'm thinking, you know, he didn't have a dense schedule while he's sitting in jail, right? I mean, a lot of time to reflect, kind of like people like Whitfield and Wesley, you know, they crossed the Atlantic and they would just soak in scripture and memorize scripture and pray and think about things. And then they hit the ground with this burst of activity that exhausted them, to be sure. But they'd had 7 weeks on a boat, not doing a whole lot.
Yeah, and then we obviously see in the Gospels that Jesus, at least, you know, there's a handful of mentions of him retreating to himself in order to pray, or even the disciples, I can recall, in one narrative where he's essentially, or I assume, praying throughout the night. He's interrupted in that activity. And, you know, I think that that's obviously extremely important to be able to fill up in that way in order to pour out. And I think to go back to kind of this point of the imbalance, I do think that there is a proclivity and there has been manifestation of people, let's just say that one of the ways I talk about it is withdrawals outnumber deposits in people's lives. And I've also heard one particular former pastor talk about the gifts in his life outlasting the fruit in his life.
What does that mean? I don't know what that means. This sounds important.
Okay, so he had a pretty public and significant fall. From grace, shall we say. That's the phrase. I don't know if I like that phrase, but that's what people say. And when he reflects upon the season of his life where he was addicted specifically to prescription drugs, I don't know if other substances were involved there, his ministry was thriving. And so the external fruit, if you will, or the external success was pretty clear, but there was an internal rotting that was going on, and it was very destructive for him. And essentially, he would say that his gifts were what were carrying him in order for the ministry to be, quote, successful.
Yes.
But it was a significant lack of personal fruit.
Got it.
In his own life.
Personal godliness.
Personal holiness, yeah, communion. Yeah, and right. even some of those times of, like you're talking about, of, you know, that Paul and Jesus and others had to be able to reflect and to be still.
Right.
Those times, as far as I can understand, and he's spoken very publicly about this, were consumed often, or the way that he would basically downshift would be through escape and numbing of an unhealthy addiction.
Right. So one of the things, boy, they could go in a variety of directions. So when you say the gifts outran the fruit, you mean the spiritual personal fruit, not the external fruit, right? Just to be clear.
Yeah, and in fact, almost the exact opposite.
I mean, right,
I've even heard Eugene Peterson was quoted at one point when he said at one of the most unhealthy periods of his life in ministry, he received the biggest raise he had ever gotten.
Right, yeah, because they loved his performance, exactly. And I know an author who also, you know, just churning out books and dying inside under the weight of, and he became, you know, they were well-received books. They were very good books. He became kind of famous for a while because of those books, but he was killing himself, and he knew it. So that's there's no question that's a significant problem. One of the things I've noticed is that when I'm just wrapping up a period of being an interim pastor at a lovely church, and as we're saying goodbye and they're thanking me for my time there, they're often commenting on my wife and saying, you know, the two of you, just the way you love each other, and you know, you sit close at church before you preach, and we see you singing together, and it's just so wonderful. And I'm thinking, well, that's That's just normal. You shouldn't even be paying attention to that. That's just ordinary behavior. And then, of course, when enough people say it, you think, well, obviously some people have not seen that or have worried about that. So I think, honestly, that one of the biggest benefits of my ministry is that my wife is a transparently happy person, which means I can't be a monster, right? You can't have a woman who's this happy who has a stinkamundo husband. I mean, I'm not the perfect husband by a long shot, but I can't be terrible. And it makes, you know, it shows some kind of work-life balance that makes people think this is genuine. I mean, I've been really wrestling with this lately. Why do people comment on what they perceive in my marriage?
Well, speaking of, this could go in a lot of directions.
Yeah, it could.
For one, I think it definitely testifies to the primary point you're making. On a secondary level, that could be an interesting foray into the congregation's view of the pastor and his life,
yeah,
and his wife and his family, yeah, et cetera, for better or worse. And,
yes.
And if we want to bring this a little bit maybe full circle back to the nature of the conversation in general, even apart from the specific point, that would be another aversion that people would have to,
yes,
wanting to be in pastoral,
yes,
ministry. They, and maybe specifically their wives, do not want the, mm-hmm, congregation looking at them in a fishbowl. And so while, mm, you're giving this example right now, the irony of it is you're speaking of it favorably.
Right.
I would imagine there could be some listeners that would hear that in an unfavorable way and think, that's exactly one of the reasons why I don't want to go into pastoral
ministry.
There's
no question, you're right.
I don't want people making comments about my wife or my marriage, et cetera.
Yep, that's exactly right. And so I want to be very careful to lest anybody hear this and draw the wrong conclusion. This church has had a huge turnover during my time. I started sort of post-COVID, so it's not a comment on the previous pastor at all. I mean, the turnover has just been enormous at the church, and the church has grown a lot. So it's a lot of people never met the previous pastor. Probably half the people never met the previous pastor. So their comments are not about him and his wife. But it's true, a lot of people are introverted and they don't want to be checked out on the introversion, extroversion happiness scale. But let's talk about a couple other things. Do you think, you're a pastor, you're in Tennessee. Is your church politicized? Is that a problem? Do you feel the weight of the decline of Western Christianity? And you're not an anxious person at all, but I mean, you and I both, of course, know a lot of 25 and 30-year-olds who are anxious. It is the age of anxiety. What else are you experiencing, Brent?
Well, first thing I would say, I don't know that I'm not an anxious person. I definitely sometimes play an anxious person. I'd like to think that I'm not at my core that anxious. But yeah, I mean, I think that this is, for one, definitely relevant. I mean, you know, I think that as you're talking about, let's say, kind of combined two concepts there as far as the political divide that exists, and which is, you know, a testimony to where the current cultural and sociological situation is and what the interface is with that and the decline of the church, you know, in the Western part of the world. I think both of those fall under this reality that the culture has shifted dramatically for a lot of people right now. And so if that's maybe an umbrella type assertion, two ways that the culture has shifted are the two things you mentioned, the at least experientially. Now, I know we could argue and you could talk, not that you and I would argue, but I get that there's nothing new under the sun. I get that, you know, it's not uncommon for things to not be bipartisan, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, that's impacted us in some significant ways. I would say that in my particular community, in our church, and I think this is just really a testimony of God's grace, but also part of it is we're only 6 years old. I was the founding pastor. You, in that situation, you're able to have a lot more influence over ethos and culture. And so with that, from day one, and by God's grace, this has continued to be true. When we started with 8 families and now we have, you know, 150 families, you know, hundreds of people, et cetera. I'm thankful that politics have not played a large part in our church body together. However, I do definitely see them manifesting significantly in our community at,
yes,
large. I mean, Knoxville's a pretty interesting place.
Right, right.
Even though it's somewhat southern, it was northern in the Civil War. It's not deeply southern. The city,
right,
of Knoxville is more blue than red. The county is more red than blue.
The university makes it kind of bluish, right?
Yeah, and there's some other institutions as well, and there's a pretty considerable number of transplants even prior to this recent exodus of the West Coast and the Northeast, but we're receiving a lot of that. That's changing our environment here politically. But as far as the decline of the church and people having an aversion to pick up into the institution, that's been a great moment for us actually as a church plant. Just once again, by God's grace, we've been able to really connect significantly with the nuns and the duns in this environment.
So let me go back to, let me connect the nuns and the duns to, I've got two books I brought, and connect that to leadership aversion, work-life balance or imbalance. So the two books I have in front of me are From Strength to Strength by a guy named Arthur Brooks, who's a Christian of some stripe. I think he's a Catholic, but really seems to have a lot his hand on a lot of things. This is a book for people who are sort of 48 or 50 plus. It's called subtitles, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. And that book is kind of it's a don't work so hard book. It's a evaluate how hard you're working at what you're doing so that you make sure you're not just pursuing success, even as your skills erode, which is inevitable. Not all skills, but a lot of skills erode. Most obvious with things like mathematicians and athletes, but everybody's skills erode to some degree. So find your passions, use your skills creatively, know what you're still good at, and so forth. And then I've got another book here about the great dechurching, which reminds me that there is a debate between people who view church two ways. One view is church doesn't demand enough anymore, which is why people aren't, you know, finding their community there the way they used to and should. And on the other hand, the church demands too much. I mean, every time I come to church, you make me feel guilty because I'm not here more and doing more. And my life is so busy, and leave me alone. So that's a part of this picture, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, and once again, I get your aversion to the word balance, but I mean, I've got a pastor friend who was a church planter. His church is definitely not a plant anymore, but he says the church wears people out and makes them feel guilty,
right,
which is in direct contrast to the fact that Jesus came to give us rest and to liberate us.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that is an experience, unfortunately, that a lot of people have, but you know, I mean, in that great dechurching, a lot of people have read the recent article by Jake Meter in The Atlantic, right, and which is essentially a summary of some of the findings of that book. And, you know, that's one of the conclusions that he comes to, at least in that article in The Atlantic, as, you know, that basically the great dechurching is happening for a reason that a lot of people are unfamiliar with, which and essentially what they're asserting is that today's life, generally speaking, outside the church, is not made well for people wanting to and connecting to the church. And, and there's a lot of different aspects of that. But his solution, at least in the article, which I guess is maybe summarizing a solution from the book. I've got it on my desk, but haven't opened it yet.
Right.
That is the book. Is that, the church needs to ask more. I mean, I'm a George Orwell. It makes me think of him. He talks about when it comes to the pinch, human beings are heroic. And the leaders who ask blood, sweat, toil, and tears, of course, quoting Churchill, will get more out of their people than those who ask very little.
Yes.
And I think that still would hold true because I think it's inherent to human nature, not just in World War II Great Britain.
Yeah. Although, you know, it's also probably true that people are drawn to. I mean, I've read the same Jake Metter's work. People are simultaneously drawn to and repulsed by the demands that the church lays on them. So it seems to me. I mean, I had a conversation not too long ago where somebody called me up short, and I was talking about the prevalence of traveling teams and how, you know, families say, oh, we're never in church. We never see our friends on the weekends. I said, well, yeah, because you have three kids and they're in three traveling teams and you put it together and it's 31 weekends a year. So don't be surprised if you're not at church much, and not just church, but you don't see your friends in general. I mean, if you give yourself to that life. And I dared to say, which was a true statement, you know, my kids did all right in sports, even though we didn't sign up for the traveling teams. Now, part of it was because they were good athletes, but not great. It was also partly because we were in Christian circles that, you know, didn't demand Sundays. You could function without being on traveling teams. And then, you know, one of them especially blossomed later on and achieved a lot, but it didn't stop her. And the person said to me, Dan, your kids were little a couple, 3 decades ago. It's different now. Don't tell me about the way things were. I'm going to tell you about the way things are. It's impossible.
That's an, you know, you and I've talked, we share a lot of things in common, including a love for sports and athletics. And so I know that we can't spend the rest of the time talking about that, but that comment that your friend told you is true. I have two teenagers right now, both are above average athletes for sure, and therefore are involved in some more of the competitive aspects of soccer is kind of their choice along with school. And, you know, I think that this is indicative in other ways of this is indicative of our culture, and you see it manifested in other ways, but the gap is widening. So like, even when I was playing sports when I was younger, there was some level of like middle ground. You right. could have still a semi-competitive environment
right.
and not be completely sold out, or you could have just a for fun recreational. And right. today there's very little middle ground. You're yeah. either going to be, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, in a very recreational / non-competitive environment, or you're going to sell half your soul to the devil and do the travel thing. It's a yeah. hard deal, but that I know that's not our total purpose to yeah. get yeah. off on that, but that's true.
Yeah. Hey, there's one more thing I really want to make sure we hit about the life of a pastor and the life of a leader. So I'm just going to back up and say, I want to make sure, you know, you're a pastor, I'm a pastor, at least sort of kind of a pastor, mostly a professor. We don't want to give the idea that we think that being a pastor is the hardest or most demanding job. It's not. I think being a CEO, CFO, CIO, whatever is harder. I actually think that owning your own small business is very, very difficult and has a lot of similarities to pastoral life in the sense that, this is what I want you to comment on, in the sense that we struggle, pastors struggle with the immense diversity of the requirements or skill sets we need. So you have to be a public speaker if you're a leader, lead mm-hmm. pastor. You also have to be a researcher. Those are kind of antithetical. It could be anyway, quietly at home and yet making a public presentation to a lot of people. And then, of course, you have to be a counselor and a manager. You have to know something about finances. You have to know something about reconciliation between people who are at odds with each other. You need to have a certain degree of legal knowledge, and you have to have skills at managing, leading, and developing the talent, if you will, if you have a church of any size. So it's an enormous array of skills that are required. I do believe that small business owners are required to have at least as many skills, maybe more. But it is an issue, and you and I both struggle at times with the sheer number of things we're supposed to be good at. I personally struggle more with the whipsaw effect. It's like I like counseling, but it exhausts me. And to move from counseling to sermon preparation, I find almost impossible. I almost cannot do it. I have to mow the lawn or go for a walk or ride my bike or something as an interlude to make the transition. You've wrestled with the same thing. What comments do you have for us?
Oh, boy. Yeah. That is a huge issue. I mean, I got it. Deal in our church that I was interacting with our session about. And so that's our key leaders. And I presented enough facts to them about the situation. And a lot was being asked of us. And these are not bad things that this person was asking of us. But one of the elders responded to just say, I think that the scope of what's being asked of us is outside of our lane mm-hmm. or outside of our lanes. And I think that is being asked of pastors a lot. And I think it's an interesting problem. Yes. And so I do think if we're thinking one of the big themes here is what's keeping people out of the ministry, I would say this level of expectation. I mean, I don't know that you would want to call it to be a generalist if we want to use maybe doctoral terms. It's almost like pastors at times are required to be 4 different specialists
yeah.
in this regard. And that is not, I'll put it this way. I would not say that there's a very reasonable chance to succeed in that type of matrix. And then I'll add one other comment. A lot of the things that I think people are asking of pastors or that pastors are choosing to do either because they feel like they have to, are afraid to disappoint people, don't have the courage to set boundaries. That's right. a whole other,
yep.
I think, significant conversation. Yep. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are a lot of other people that can do a lot of the things either in the church or even outside the church that people are looking to a pastor to do
yes.
when not a lot of other people can preach the word. not a lot of other people, at least in our circles, can administer the sacraments. Not a lot of other people can offer learned, trained, experiential spiritual direction.
Right.
And so I do think that if churches and people would narrow that to what our calling actually is, I think that would help lure more people back to this calling, which is a real blessing.
Yeah, I'm going to comment two ways on what you're saying. First of all, I might disagree with you mildly that we're expected to be experts at four areas. What I call it is omnicompetence. That is, you're not excelling in everything. You know, I think we need to excel at one thing, but you better be pretty good with regard to finances and counseling and managing the staff. So it's not, I'm not all the way disagreeing, maybe just a little bit on that particular one. But I agree that we need to make sure that we're not trying to act as if we're skilled at everything. But if you're willing to switch gears with me for a minute, I want to try to apply some of these points that we're making to another field. And it also has to do with the question of the level of commitment that people have and the level of commitment people are afraid to make. So I'm going to try something out on you, and that is that it's not just vocations that are hard. So people are afraid of pastoral vocations, but they're also afraid of being CEOs, and they're also afraid of or afraid of jobs that are corporate ladder-ish. You know, I've got to work 70 or 80 hours for 5 years to get anywhere. People are shying away from that kind of job at times, unless the rewards are very high. Looking for jobs that are 37 to 45 hours a week, pay pretty well, but not highly demanding. I can still go kayaking on weekends if I have this job. That's kind of the ideal job, or mountain climbing, or trail running, whatever it is they like to do. But I do think that that attitude carries over to other fields of life. I think it is part of the reason why people are afraid to get married or not getting married as much these days, because people say marriage is hard. And it is. And then full stop. Like, I just said something really important, and I've just told you something you need to know. So I know you've said at one point, it's very important. I like to talk to you because you label what's happening at what generation or what decade. And you said once to me that Seinfeld made it clear that marriage is hard. And then, you know, Seinfeld went off the year, I forget, 97 or 98, whatever year it was. And it's like during those same years, pastors, it's almost like they discovered marriage is hard. And they should say marriage is hard. Well, we already know that. We already know it's hard. What we need to hear from you is not that marriage is hard. We need to hear from you that marriage is hard but worth it. Marriage is hard but glorious. Marriage is hard but beautiful. And we need you to accept the point that we all know, which is hard, and not stop there and tell us why we should proceed with this difficult thing, because so many of the best things in life are difficult and worth achieving. I mean, real happiness, doesn't it come from putting yourself into something that makes you happy at a cost? That's what people find, at least in the research. But I know you've thought about this a lot. Tell us what you think about that topic.
Yeah, you caught my analogy almost correctly as far as Seinfeld. The comment I was making about that, especially doing so much premarital counseling with college students for so many years and talking about marriage, it occurred to me that so many people, Christians with good intentions, thought that they were doing people a favor by making sure they understood how hard marriage was, as if they were speaking against a cultural ideal, which was marriage is amazing. Right. And what I said was that changed up. Maybe Leave It to Beaver said that, but you know, at least at Seinfeld, if not in other ways too, what the culture started saying a long time ago was marriage is a joke.
Right.
It's not even that it's hard. It's just a joke. It's irrelevant. And so I think that, the sentiment is the same. And that's where I'm afraid that we are right now in this realm, if we want to carry that analogy into the pastoral realm. I mean, I think it's good for us to some degree to lament in a healthy way the challenges and some of the difficulties of what it's like, you know, to be a pastor. But I mean, we also have to put that in the context of it's hard to be a person.
Yes.
in a broken world. And things really are hard. One of the phrases that came out of the pandemic era that I actually kind of like is people kind of created this rally cry of we can do hard things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we do need to biblically embrace that by the strength and the dependence that we have on God and realize that life is hard. Yes, ministry's hard. Yes. Marriage is hard. Parenting's hard. Like, there is no avoiding the hard. And in fact, a lot of the things that are the most significant, the most meaningful, the most lasting, and this is a unique and a really great thing about our profession, we don't have to wonder about, will this matter? You know, I mean, I'm sure you, like I, have talked to a ton of people that are Christians that are serving in the private sector or in industry,
right,
et cetera, that really have to question existentially, does what I'm doing as a chemist even matter?
Mm-hmm.
Does what I'm doing as a lawyer even really matter? And of course, we want to encourage them.
Right.
Of course it does, God, you know, all these things. But like a unique and a really compelling thing about vocational ministry and specifically the pastorate is, you actually don't have to wonder truthfully, if we're going to be guided by the scriptures, whether what we're doing matters. I mean, God tells us his word never returns void.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to stand up and preach it untold numbers of weeks,
right,
every year.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Hi, I'm John Perkins, Executive Director of the Center for Faith and Work St. Louis. You've been listening to our podcast, Working with Dan Doriani. The Center also offers conferences on faith and work throughout the United States. Our goal is to equip formal and informal leaders to make a difference in their corner of the world. We equip Christian leaders to run 10-hour faith and work cohorts on 3 continents. Please visit our website at faithandworkstl.org to see how your church or organization can form a faith and work cohort for people who have, or aspire to, a leadership role in their workplace. Now, back to Dan.
So, Dan, years ago, you shared with me, you have, I don't know what you want to call it, a philosophy, an assertion, whatever you want to call, that my understanding or interpretation is high-level leaders, kind of tip-of-the-spear jobs in institutions, whether
right.
this is in the church or even outside the church, I
yeah.
think
right.
you asserted, essentially have a 10-year shelf life. Like, after 10 years, a number of things, typically, I'm sure there's exceptions, start to basically have diminishing returns.
Yeah.
You've said things like, you've been in the pulpit for 10 years, guess what? They've pretty much heard everything you have to say.
Right.
Doesn't mean you can't learn anything new, but like chances are it's not going to really sound that new.
Right.
And then even for your own experience in that role after 10 years, there really is, and I don't know any other way to say it other than there's just some level of like boredom that could set in, lack of new challenge.
Yeah.
You find it to be, you can kind of dial it in ways
yes.
that end up not sometimes even, and it works both ways, because a lot of times when people stay too long, they're not as effective.
Right.
And you know, and then it's kind of a chicken and an egg. It's like, are you not as effective because you burned out, or are you burning out because you're not as effective? But I think your little thought on 10 years could really be a compelling, let's call it, advertisement into a potential role.
Yeah, let me develop that a little bit. So you heard me correctly. I have said 10 years for sure. On other occasions, I've said 8 to 12. And it depends on who you are. And some people just like a new challenge on a regular basis. I mean, if you look at professional people, leaders of corporations, some of them do stay for 20 years. It's pretty unusual. You take college presidents, university presidents, average 10 years, 7 or 8 years now. They get in there, they work on a program. They have things they want to accomplish. And then after 7 or 8 years, they've accomplished it. They also had to knock a few heads. They made some enemies. They made some tough decisions people didn't like. And their tenure is over. I mean, it's not by accident the presidents only have 8 years. Nobody's saying, oh, we're going to move it up to 12. No, after 8 years, you've done what you can do. Now, a lot of fields, you can go 12 years, and I have no problem with pastors going 12 or 15 years, and certainly small business owners. But even small business owners, they generally, if they're successful, they generally sell their business before they're ready to retire. And sometimes they sell it way beforehand, and then they'll keep a little chunk of their business and start something new, or maybe several somethings new. I've seen this over and over with my businessy friends who are successful. They're doing new things. They're not just, you know, running barges or information firms or transportation firms. They say, I got to do something different. So that's, I think there's a lot to human nature, but I also think to be honest, to go to the church and other leadership situations, people worry that somebody's going to be around forever and their skills become familiar and their strengths become taken for granted and their weaknesses become grating. Are they ever going to stop doing this thing that they do? Which is maybe endearing for the first few years because it was funny, but come on, grow up, stop doing this. We don't want to pick up your mess anymore. And one of the best ways to overcome that kind of, and then we're going to push him out. We're going to make his life miserable, or her life miserable for that matter, in a lot of occupations. Just get out of there. You know, don't let them worry that you're going to be there forever. I'm moving on. You can have a new person. Sometimes, Brent, I think that the best thing for pastors would be to say, no way am I going to do more than 7 years. Because yeah. Then if you're mad at me, you can endure me for 7 years and I've got skills enough and you don't have to murder me and make my life miserable, because I promise I'm going to leave.
Well, yeah, and even on the pastor, so you're speaking about it on the congregational side of things, as far as from that perspective, which is relevant. On the pastor side of things, even if you didn't communicate that externally, but you had somewhat of an inner commitment or conviction to that, it can do a number of things. One, I think it could give you a certain boldness and courage, because you're not so dependent on offending people and having to do this and not doing that, because you've essentially already decided. Now, we're always open to God's redirection, of course. But at that point, you're pretty much saying, you know, after about 10 years, I'm going to be on waivers. I'm getting traded. I'm going to sign a new contract. You know, something. And then that just kind of gives you, and I really mean this, I think it's an actual good selling point, because I do think that people sometimes have a reluctance because they think Eugene Peterson and Wendell Berry told them
they have to
faithfully plow
the same
road
field
that you
for 30 years.
Yeah, forever. Yep, and right. that's what it means to be godly. And I just simply say, That's an exception.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of literature that says one of the best ways to be productive and honestly joyful is to keep moving around. There's a book called Range by Epstein, I forget his first name, that I just love and read 1.5 times. And it basically says the best way to keep building your skills is to have a range of skills, and maybe a core, but to use it in different ways. If you're a researcher, don't research the same thing year after year after year. Research something else. Move over from chemistry to biology. You can do it. Or from chemistry to physics, it can be done. I would want to go back a little bit, however, to another question, the topic of reluctance to work hard. And I know, people say we can do hard things. I'm not sure I buy it, to be honest. I think people say it because they want to say it, not because they want to do it. And I do connect it to some degree to the current decline in childbirth rates. We have a lot of people now choosing to be childless because it's just too hard. They're too inconvenient. And I've heard a couple interviews recently from people who say, I want to be able to have the life I want. I want to be able to hop on a plane and go to Martha's Vineyard one weekend and go to Portland, Oregon the next, if I choose. And having little kids makes that impossible or painful. So I'm not going to have kids because I just don't want my life to be that complicated. Now, that's interviews I've heard, but there's statistical verification of that. There are more and more people who are choosing childlessness because it's too hard. And there are people, of course, choosing not to get married because it's too hard or stupid or vain or too restricting or whatever.
Yeah. So David Brooks, I think it was 2 weeks ago, New York Times opinion columnist, professing Christian as a side note, read a great piece on marriage, and it was a very pro-marriage piece. And he essentially was comparing how people put so much emphasis on building their career and orienting their lives around their career with the assumption that if I'm successful in my career, I'll be a happy person.
Right.
And he was actually making the argument with some, you know, research thrown in there. Obviously, this wasn't, you know, a deeply statistical piece here, that actually, you know, people are happier when they're married.
Right.
But I think he's kind of along those same, in that same vein, that people are avoiding it because of these perceptions of difficulty, et cetera, which is just true across, for humans.
It's not controllable. You can marry somebody and find out, oh my goodness, I made a huge mistake. Or you marry somebody and love them and they decide to abandon you. That happens. Career feels more controllable because it's just you working long hours. I think that's part of it. But else, you're absolutely right, and I was thinking the same kind of literature, that marriage is hard but great. So, I mean, the literature on the good life seems to indicate that people who live for the happiness of the moment, like going to a funny movie or going to a great live show of some kind or traveling to Martha's Vineyard, gives a lot more short-term happiness, but it doesn't give long-term satisfaction of life. What gives long-term satisfaction of life is things that are good, like having children, getting married, and having long-term friendships, but hard and demand endurance and development of skills.
Yeah, I kind of think about it like almost like an elasticity of the heart.
Yes.
To the extent that you're willing to let your heart be stretched, let's say, into difficulty, it also creates an increased capacity for satisfaction. So it kind of reminds me of that often quoted C.S. Lewis on love, where he talks about if you give your heart to anyone, yeah, it could be wrung and possibly broken and you'd be hurt. But the alternative is that you close it up and that you're never hurt, but you also become completely isolated, lonely, and you lack satisfaction. And I think that's similar, you know, in this conversation, whether it be childlessness, whether it be marriage, or whether we get into our previous conversation, I actually think the principle kind of remains. Yeah, and I hear you on the COVID thing. I'm just saying that was a phrase.
Yeah.
We can do hard things. Yeah. I agree. I don't think people really want to do hard things. I think, unfortunately, today, not many people are doing hard things. You know, I think that, you know, we all want to work remote. We don't want to be in the office, right? That, like, it's interesting that movement came out of the we can do hard things, and then when it comes to
right.
the bargaining
and we don't want a manager
table,
looking over our shoulder.
Yeah, I can do hard things, but don't make me come back into the city to the office
right.
building to work.
That commute
but
is too difficult.
I like the idea of doing hard things.
Right, right. He protests too much. Hey, there are huge payoffs, though, for marriage and children. Of course, you're not there yet, but grandchildren are one of the rewards for putting in the labor. You know, you don't get to have the joy of playing tickle and chase games with little kids for 3 hours or 2 hours, whatever the time frame is, and give them back to their parents, right? Unless you go through the hard work of having children and raising them and doing well enough, to be honest, with them that they want you to be around their children. That's not inconsequential that our children want or don't want us to be around their children. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I look for it. You're right. I'm not with two teenagers. I'm not there yet, but I'm sure it'll be here before I know it. Hopefully, yeah, that's something that we would love to be able to experience. I'm curious in your thought pattern. What is the thread that led you to your waxing on grandparenting right now?
I mean, I just love it so much. My grandchildren all live in St. Louis, and I have a new one, a month old, and so it's kind of, I view it as my sacred duty to help the three-year-old to feel awesome because I still shower 98% of my attention on her when I see her. So that, you know, she's not like, what happened to me? I was the center of the universe and I'm not anymore. So I tell her, honestly, you are my favorite little girl in the whole world. You're not my favorite girl, but you're my favorite little girl because I've got other granddaughters as well. But I do believe that hard work has payoffs. That's what I'm driving at. And I do think that if you work hard, for example, my former leadership is preparing sermons, which is work, and then working hard to communicate as best I can to people and working with elders who might all agree and they might not all agree about things, and then codifying, writing down, taking time to write down what I learned from these events. And then slowly you gain wisdom. And surprisingly, eventually, when you work at something long enough, you actually know a lot of stuff. And when you know a lot of stuff, people want to hear your counsel. You know, they want your help. And I'm not trying to be self-promoting, but hard work has benefits. But it is hard work. And you're not going to gain the fruit of hard work if you only talk about hard work as an ideal. And admittedly, you have to know how to pull back and you have to know when to stop and know the limits of human capacity and make sure you have time to pray and meditate and be with your friends and be with your family. But I think you have to put in the work and the results come imperfectly. It's not a perfect tie-in, right? You can be just crazy blessed and you can work hard and see very few results because of events that occurred. It's not your fault at all. I'm not minimizing that. But there is a correlation.
That makes a ton of sense. If I could jump in and give a cycling analogy for a moment, which would not be exclusive to cycling, this would be characteristic of a number of endurance sports. If you think about, let's just say, heart rates. And so zone two is very manageable. And in fact, you know, a lot of research right now, even I think amongst elite cyclists, pro cyclists, most training, a lot of training, they say, is healthy to do in zone two, which is honestly relatively easy and very sustainable to some degree. You can elongate that from distances, et cetera. But the whole point of being able to do zone two workouts regularly is to be able to excel and hit zone three and four. Yes. To be able to, you know, in the Tour de France, climb Alpe d'Huez.
Right, right.
Now, you can't do that nonstop. And so if you think about it, but when you do it, the satisfaction of having done that is unlike any other. So like if I go out for a ride, sure, I like sometimes just going and it being zone two the whole time. And it's pretty fun and easy. And there's a level of enjoyment and satisfaction. But boy, there is a real high level of enjoyment and satisfaction of doing a climb in our mountains here in East Tennessee, which taxes me more into an upper level output and then having the satisfaction of that being over. But it's unsustainable to do that nonstop. So if you make that, let's go back to the vocational idea is, you know, and maybe even right where we began in the work-life balance. I mean, you know, the cadence is more often than not zone two.
Yes.
But it's unavoidable to stay out of zone three and four. You're going to have to do things that are going to require significant strength and difficulty in order to climb. And when you do that, it's actually really, really satisfying. But in order to continue to sustain it, you got to go back down to zone two.
Well, and you have to go to zone one for that matter. I mean,
that would be recovery, right? Yeah. So like that's true. And if that's actually an important point to be able to make, especially after you've taxed yourself on that level. And,
right.
But point being, it's very satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, to do something hard.
It is. And I'm just thinking, I was reading a biography of a great author, and he would have these binges of writing and just write and write and write and, you know, crank out a book in 4 months that was good. And then then after it was done, he would berate himself for being such a sloth and such a sluggard. Well, I mean, he depleted himself and he goofed around and didn't do much, wouldn't start working until 10 o'clock because he'd put in this titanic effort to complete a significant book, not just a book, but a good book, a demanding, influential book in 4 or 5 months. Well, I don't know. I think our time might be almost at an end. Maybe we've come and gone. We've had a good conversation. Do you have one more thing you want to say before we go, Brent?
I really don't think so. I think it's a stimulating conversation, and I think there's a lot more, obviously, that could be said on it. I'm grateful to be able to participate in the conversation with you, and I think there's enough commonality that we share about this, but also not only age and stage and some other differences. I think you and I are wired more similarly than different, but not the exact same.
Different enough.
I hope it's helpful with each of us, you know, coming from our own vantage point over a common topic.
I love to agree with people most of the time, but it scares me when I agree with them all the time, because we could just plunge off the cliff together, merrily agreeing on something that's a total disaster.
Yeah, I think in the history of our friendship, we've checked most boxes, but not all boxes.
Yeah, there we go.
Always.
There we go.
And so I think that's good.
Yeah. So my guest today, my conversation partner today has been Brent Harriman. He's been a campus pastor and a supervisor of campus pastors, and he's now the lead pastor of a wonderful, healthy, growing church in Knoxville, Tennessee called Resurrection Church. He's also a man who's stood the test of time with his delightful wife and his children. He's been a loyal friend in many ways and a good conversation partner today. Thank you so much, Brent.
Thanks for having me.
Working with Dan Doriani is a production of the Center for Faith and Work St. Louis. We seek to promote faithfulness in the workplace, in education, in discipleship, and in the stories of believers who've applied their faith at work. If you want to put your faith to work and change your corner of the world, visit our website, the Center for Faith and Work St. Louis. Look for faithandworkstl.org. That's one word. We'll help you start a cohort with like-minded believers who also want to practice their faith at work. This podcast is donor-supported. To keep us going, please donate on our website. Maybe more importantly, you can support us by listening, by subscribing, by sharing, by liking us, by posting us on your favorite platform, or go old school and tell a friend.